This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.
So what if I told you that one of the most complex restaurant quality culinary experiences you can have, a meal that literally arrives at your table violently sizzling and popping, you know, sounding almost like a tiny rainstorm, takes exactly 30 minutes to make.
Right. And it requires zero specialized cooking skills.
Exactly. And the craziest part is it doesn't even contain a single ounce of meat.
It really is wild when you think about it.
It is. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are entirely demystifying the Stone Bowl today. We're looking at a highly focused culinary dossier, essentially a source pack we've been given, dedicated entirely to one iconic staple of Korean cuisine.
Yeah, and the mission today is to explore Korean food basically one plate or I guess one bowl at a time.
Right. And if you, the listener, standing in your kitchen right now, if you have ever stared at a beautiful photograph of international cuisine and just thought there's absolutely no way I can pull off those flavors at home, well, this deep dive is going to fundamentally change how you approach your weeknight dinners.
I really think it will because, you know, it's a universal barrier for the home cook. We tend to build these invisible, intimidating walls around certain types of international food.
Oh, totally. We absolutely do.
We convince ourselves that unless we have access to obscure restaurant supply stores or like a grandmother who passed down highly guarded secret techniques, we are just destined to fail.
Yeah, we see the vibrant, multicolored presentation of traditional Korean food. We see the sheer variety of components.
And we automatically assume it requires an entire weekend of prep time and an intimate knowledge of complex culinary arts.
Which, to be fair, makes sense on the surface. I mean, when you sit down at a Korean restaurant, you are immediately greeted by a dozen tiny dishes, the banchan, and then this magnificent steaming main course arrives.
Right. It feels like an orchestration that takes hours.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. The specific dish we are focusing on today from our sources is dulsuk bibimbap. But before we get into the mechanics of how it is cooked, we need to establish exactly what we are talking about. Because the name itself gives us the blueprint, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And to really understand why this dish is so fundamentally approachable for you at home, we have to start with the linguistic terminology the dossier provides.
Right, the breakdown of the words.
Exactly. So bibimbap quite literally translates to mixed rice. Bibim means mixed, and bap means rice.
Just rice, got it.
And then dulsat refers to the specific vessel it is served in, which is a stone bowl.
Okay, so dulsat bibimbap translates directly to stone bowl mixed rice.
Yes, and that's actually how it's most commonly searched for.
Yeah.
Within the broader architecture of Korean food, the dossier places this firmly in the rice category.
Now, I want to clarify that categorization real quick, because when we say it belongs in the rice category, we aren't just talking about a standard side of steamed white rice, right?
Right, I don't know.
Like, the kimchi just sits on the table to soak up the sauce from a main protein. We are talking about the rice acting as the structural foundation for a singular, self-contained ecosystem of a meal. You have the rice, the assorted vegetables, the sauce, and usually an egg, all just existing together.
That is a crucial distinction.
Yeah.
An ecosystem is actually the perfect word for it. It is a complete, self-contained nutritional and flavor matrix.
The matrix, yeah.
The rice is the literal base layer upon which the entire meal is built and ultimately mixed. But what is truly remarkable here, and this is one of the most surprising and frankly encouraging statistics from the source material, is the accessibility factor.
This is the part that blew my mind.
Right. Despite the fact that this is a visually stunning, complete meal, and despite the impressive high-end presentation of a literal hot stone bowl sizzling at your table, the dossier explicitly rates the expected difficulty level of this dish as easy.
Okay, I have to challenge that easy rating and the timeline that comes with it. The source pack claims the expected cooking time is only about 30 minutes.
30 minutes, yes.
If I am looking at a bowl that has five or six different meticulously prepared vegetables, perfectly cooked rice, and a complex sauce, I don't buy that I can go from a standing start to a sizzling stone bowl in 30 minutes without cutting serious corners.
It sounds totally counterintuitive, I know. But the 30-minute timeline is entirely accurate when you understand the mechanics of the preparation.
Okay, explain the mechanics because I'm skeptical.
Well, you are not slow roasting a massive piece of protein or reducing a complex broth for hours. You are utilizing parallel processing.
Parallel processing.
Right. So while your rice is steaming in a rice cooker or on the stove, which takes about 20 to 30 minutes, you are quickly preparing the namul, which are the seasoned vegetable components.
Ah, so multitasking.
Exactly. You might quick blanch a handful of spinach for 30 seconds, squeeze out the water, and toss it with a little garlic and sesame oil. You do the same with some bean sprouts. You quickly saute some julienne carrots.
So it's basically an assembly line of very fast, very simple microtasks.
That's exactly it.
Ah, so the complexity is an illusion created by the presentation. You are essentially just assembling perfectly seasoned, quickly cooked building blocks.
Yes.
That completely changes the mental math of deciding what to make for dinner on a Tuesday. But if it is just quickly blanched vegetables and rice, that naturally brings us to the flavor profile. Yeah. Because if we aren't spending hours braising something to build depth, what does this actually taste like? People often assume that traditional Korean dishes are fundamentally built around heavy, intensely savory marinades and meats, like Korean BBQ, or that they are overwhelmingly aggressively spicy.
What's fascinating here is that the sources give us very explicit dietary and flavor parameters for this specific dish.
Mm-hmm.
And they push back hard against those exact assumptions.
Really hard.
Yeah, the baseline for dulce bibimbap is surprisingly categorized as having a mild spice level. Mm. It is not designed to blow your palate out with fiery heat. It is an incredibly nuanced, comforting flavor experience.
A mild spice level immediately lowers the barrier to entry for anyone who might be heat averse. But I really want to zero in on the meat aspect here.
Yeah, the meat aspect is huge.
Because I know BBQ is just one facet of the cuisine, but meat often plays a central role in the popular global perception of Korean food. If we are making this fast and we are making it mild, where is the savory punch coming from?
Here's where the dossier gets incredibly specific, and it answers your question about where the flavor comes from. The core baseline recipe outlined in our sources contains no pork.
No pork.
It contains no beef. It contains no chicken. And it contains no seafood.
Wait, zero meat at all?
None.
If I strip out all the protein that usually provides the umami, you know, the deep savory notes that make a dish feel complete and satisfying, aren't I just left with a bowl of plain starch and wet vegetables?
I mean, you would think so, but no.
How is this one of the most famous dishes in the world if it is missing the foundational savory element? There has to be a mechanism replacing that depth.
There is. And it comes down to the Korean pantry staples that bind the dish together. The absence of meat absolutely does not mean absence of umami.
Okay, so what's bringing the umami?
You are relying on the complex, fermented depth of gochujang.
Ah, gochujang.
Right, it's a thick, crimson Korean chili paste made from chili powder, glutinous rice, and fermented soybeans.
Fermented soybeans, that's the key right there.
Exactly. It provides a sweet, earthy, deeply savory warmth rather than just sharp, burning heat. Combine that with a generous drizzle of toasted sesame oil, which brings an incredibly rich, nutty aroma. Mm. And you have a massive flavor payload that doesn't require a single ounce of meat to be satisfying.
That makes total sense. The fermentation process in the gochujang is basically doing the heavy lifting that a slow-cooked meat broth normally would. It provides that savory mouth-coating satisfaction.
Precisely. And what the lack of a mandatory meat protein does is transform the stone bowl into a highly adaptable canvas.
Adaptable how?
Well, because the core identity of the dish isn't tied to a specific cut of beef or pork, the sources explicitly highlight that there is a definitive yes for vegetarian substitution.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, the baseline structure is designed to welcome diverse dietary needs naturally. You aren't compromising the authenticity of the dish or creating a lesser, you know, mock version by making it vegetarian.
Right, you're not making fake meat bibimbap.
Exactly. Yep. It is inherently friendly to that approach from the very beginning.
So it is not a compromise. It is the design. The foundation is so solid with the rice, the seasoned vegetables, the fermented gochujang, and the sesame oil that it simply doesn't rely on meat to be whole.
Great.
So if the dish leans heavily into these mild vegetable-forward elements, and it is relatively quick to prepare, the magic, the real X factor that elevates this from just a nice bowl of rice to an iconic, sought-after restaurant dish, has to lie in the physical experience of eating it.
You are touching on the absolute core of why dulce bibimbap is famous worldwide. It is not just about the ingredients. It is about the physics of the vessel.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the name itself gives away the secret weapon, the dulcet, the stone bowl.
Yes, the bowl is everything.
Our source material specifically flags two words for the home cook to focus on heavily: texture and taste. Those are the crucial elements you have to understand to pull this off properly.
They are everything. The defining feature of this dish isn't just what you place into the bowl. It is the violent, active interaction between the core ingredients and the bowl itself.
The interaction.
Right, because the dulcet is carved from porous stone.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just a heavy serving dish meant to look rustic. It is a highly functional cooking vessel with an immense thermal mass.
Thermal mass, I've got.
That means it takes a while to get hot, but once it is screaming hot, it refuses to cool down.
So when the waiter sets it down on your table, it isn't just keeping your food warm. It is actively, aggressively cooking the food while you are sitting there holding your spoon.
Yes. The traditional preparation involves heating that stone bowl directly on the stove flame until it is dangerously hot.
Dangerously hot. Wow.
Then you brush the inside with a layer of toasted sesame oil, and you immediately press the cooked white rice directly against the sides and the bottom of the stone.
Oh, so you are essentially creating a miniature heavy-duty frying pan right there at the table.
Exactly. The intense heat from the stone, combined with the sesame oil, triggers a rapid Maillard reaction.
Well, right, the Maillard reaction, the browning of the carbohydrates in the rice.
Yes. It toasts the rice at the very bottom, creating a signature, highly prized texture called naringi.
Naringi.
Right. It is this golden, incredibly crispy, almost cracker-like layer of rice that adheres to the bowl.
And that is the taste and texture the sources are warning us to pay attention to. It is that dramatic contrast.
Yeah, contrast is key.
You are eating the mild, comforting, soft steamed vegetables, the tender rice from the top, the rich gochujang sauce, and then suddenly your spoon scrapes the bottom and you hit this incredible, nutty, crunchy layer of fried rice.
Oh, it's the best part.
Plus, there is an acoustic element to it, right? The sizzling sound, the acoustic cue of the rice crisping up, makes it a fully engineered sensory experience.
It really is culinary engineering at its finest. And that thermal mass is also what allows you to drop a raw egg right into the center of the vegetables just before serve.
Oh, right, the egg.
Yeah, when you stir the bowl together. Because remember, bibimbap means mixed rice. The residual heat of the stone and the rice safely cooks the raw egg into a rich, creamy sauce that coats every single grain.
Okay, but let's advocate for the listener here. Let's be entirely realistic. Most of the people listening to this deep dive do not have heavy, specialized Korean granite bowls sitting in their cupboards next to their cereal bowls.
That's a very fair point.
If the massive thermal retention of the stone is the secret weapon to getting that crispy naringi layer, does this entire recipe just fall apart if I try to make it in a regular kitchen? Are we back to square one with kitchen intimidation?
Absolutely not. And that is the beauty of understanding the why behind the cooking method.
Okay, what's the workaround?
Once you know that the goal is high thermal mass and sustained, even heat to fry the rice in sesame oil, you can easily replicate the exact same effect with equipment you probably already own.
Which is?
A standard cast iron skillet.
A cast iron skillet, of course. It has the exact same properties. It is heavy, it holds heat forever, and it creates a fantastic crust.
Precisely. You put your cast iron skillet on the stove, let it get incredibly hot, coat the bottom with sesame oil, press your cooked rice evenly across the pan, arrange your vegetables on top, and let it sizzle until you hear that distinct crackling sound.
That is brilliant.
Right, and you serve it right out of the skillet in the center of your dining table. You achieve the exact same target taste and target texture without needing to import a stone bowl.
That is such a fantastic practical hack. It immediately democratizes the dish for everyone. But achieving that target taste and texture brings us to another massive hurdle for the home cook, which is sourcing the ingredients.
Yes, the ingredients.
Because if you are cooking this outside of Korea, you might not have access to the exact vegetables traditionally used. The dossier places a huge emphasis on understanding what it calls substitute ingredients for overseas cooks.
It is a critical section of the source material.
Yeah.
You have to know how to pivot when you are standing in a Western grocery store. And they simply do not stock traditional Korean produce.
Finding overseas substitutes is an incredibly nuanced process. It is an analogy I think about a lot. It is exactly like translating a poem from one language to another.
Oh, that is an interesting way to frame it. How does the poem analogy apply to the cutting board?
Well, think about translating a famous poem. If you just go line by line and swap out one word for its literal dictionary equivalent in the new language, you might technically get the basic meaning across.
Sure.
But you will completely destroy the rhythm, the cadence, the rhyme, and the emotional feeling of the original piece. cooking with substitute ingredients is the exact same discipline.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You cannot just look for a vegetable that happens to be green to replace another green vegetable. You have to maintain the intended target taste and the intended target texture of the overall bowl.
Right.
If the original ingredient brought an earthy crunch, your substitute must also bring an earthy crunch, or the whole poem of the dish falls apart and you lose the contrast.
That is a phenomenal analogy, and it perfectly explains why the sources strongly warn us about the common mistakes that overseas home cooks make.
What's the main mistake?
The primary mistake is failing to respect that target flavor profile. Let me give you a very concrete example based on traditional ingredients.
Please do. What is a classic substitution trap?
A very traditional ingredient in bibimbap is gosari, or fernbrake.
Gosari, okay.
It is a wild forage plant that has a very distinct, earthy, meaty flavor and a slightly chewy, resilient texture. Now, if you are in the middle of the United States and you cannot find dried gosari, a poorly considered substitute would be something like boiled zucchini.
Wait, why does zucchini ruin the poem? They are both mild vegetables.
Because zucchini has an incredibly high water content, and it turns mushy very quickly when cooked.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. If you put watery, mushy zucchini into your hot stone bowl or your cast iron skillet, it releases all that excess moisture downward.
Down into the rice.
Yes. Instead of frying in the sesame oil to create that crispy Noromji crust, the rice ends up steaming in zucchini water.
Oh, no.
You destroy the delicate textural ecosystem of the bowl. You lose the crunch, which we just established is the entire point of the dish.
Oh, wow. So one watery vegetable completely sabotages the physics of the hot stone.
Exactly. A much better structurally sound substitute for gosari would be a sliced, lightly sautéed shiitake mushroom.
A shiitake mushroom.
Yeah, it brings a similar earthy, umami-rich flavor profile. And critically, it has a firm, chewy texture that doesn't bleed excess water into your crispy rice.
That is brilliant. The advice to the listener is clear. Be creative. Absolutely. Use what is available to you at your local market, but be hyper-analytical about preserving the structural integrity of the original dish.
Yes, you have to protect the crispy rice at all costs.
It gives you permission to experiment, but it gives you a very firm scientific target to aim for.
It provides functional boundaries, which actually fosters much better creativity and confidence in the kitchen.
So we have unpacked the mechanics of the hot stone bowl. We understand the physics of the thermal mass and the Maillard reaction.
We do?
We understand the quick 30-minute parallel processing of the mild, adaptable vegetable ingredients, the umami power of gochujang, and the delicate, poetic art of translating ingredients overseas.
We've covered a lot.
We have. So what does this all mean? When you step back from the stove and look at the whole picture, what does dulsat bibimbap teach you, the listener, about Korean food as a whole?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this single dossier synthesizes three profound lessons about Korean cuisine that push back against common, intimidating global stereotypes.
Okay, what's the first lesson?
First, it demonstrates that this cuisine can be highly accessible and deeply pragmatic. We are talking about a 30-minute, easy-to-execute meal that utilizes parallel preparation.
Right, and the second?
Second, it proves that the flavor profiles can be gentle and comforting. The mild spice baseline shows a completely different side of the culinary spectrum than just fiery stews.
Exactly. And the third lesson.
And third, it highlights how endlessly structurally adaptable the food is, specifically through its naturally vegetarian-friendly foundation that relies on fermentation rather than meat for depth.
It is the perfect ambassador for a home cook who wants to step outside their comfort zone without feeling like they need to attend culinary school. It is deeply forgiving.
It truly is.
Yeah.
But there is one final, very strict boundary set by the source material that I think is incredibly important for how we culturally appreciate this food today.
Oh, what's the boundary?
The dossier explicitly, directly instructs us not to invent grandiose histories for the dish and not to claim exaggerated medical benefits.
I found that warning absolutely fascinating because you see that exact behavior everywhere on modern food blogs and social media.
Everywhere.
Every time someone posts a recipe for an ancient grain or a traditional international dish, it is suddenly framed as a mystical cure-all for every ailment. Or there's a massive preamble about how this exact bowl of rice was served to emperors 1,000 years ago on the eve of battle.
Exactly. As an audience, we have a terrible tendency to romanticize international food to the point of turning it into a caricature. We feel this weird psychological need to validate a foreign dish by attaching a mythical history or a superfood health claim to it.
As if it isn't worthy of our attention just by being delicious.
Precisely. What this source pack is telling us is profoundly simple and deeply respectful. We do not need to do that. We should appreciate Dolsa Bibimbap for exactly what it actually is.
Which is just a spectacularly designed culinary experience.
Yes. It is a brilliantly engineered, simple, well-balanced weeknight meal. Its immense value comes from its taste, its texture, the brilliant contrast of soft vegetables and crispy fried rice, and how it brings people together at the table today.
It doesn't need to be magic.
Right. It does not need an invented imperial past or a fake medical claim to be considered great.
I absolutely love that perspective. It strips away all the pretension and the exoticism. It just looks you in the eye and says, here is a heavy bowl. Here is the science of how it cooks the rice, and it tastes really, really good.
Exactly.
It respects the reality of the food, and it respects the intelligence of the person cooking it.
It grounds the entire experience purely in the physical reality of your own kitchen, whether you are using a traditional stone bowl or a cast iron skillet.
Well, I don't know about you, but I am suddenly incredibly hungry, and I am looking at my cast iron skillet with a massive amount of optimism.
I think we all are.
We started this deep dive talking about that very specific feeling of intimidation when you look at a beautiful, complex, restaurant-quality dish. You see the sizzling stone bowl arrive, you hear the violent crackle of the rice, you smell the toasted sesame oil, and you assume it is a kind of magic that belongs exclusively to the professionals.
But as we have learned by breaking down the mechanics, that magic is surprisingly accessible. It is just applied thermal mass and good timing.
It really is. Yep. So I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day. The next time you find yourself sitting at a restaurant feeling intimidated by a seemingly complex, beautifully presented dish, I want you to look past the garnishes and ask yourself a question.
It's a great question to ask.
Could the secret to all that culinary magic simply be the vessel it is cooked in? Could it just be a piece of clever ancient engineering, like a humble stone bowl sitting there, just waiting for you to try replicating it in your own kitchen?
This program is provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.